KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Welcome to The Treatment, hosted by Elvis Mitchell. I'm Jenny Radelet, producer of the show. Today's bonus podcast comes to us courtesy of film independent at LACMA, where Elvis recently welcomed the creators and stars of Portlandia, Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein. The show just embarked on its fourth season on IFC, and it's grown a lot in the past 4 years, both in pacing and character development. That's where Elvis starts the conversation.
We're just saying backstage, the first season was so packed. It was like you thought, we only going to get one season. We're going to get every single idea we ever had on television. And then this last couple of seasons have been really kind of like you taking your time. But this seventh episode is just back to that being packed full of ideas again. And you were saying you thought it might be the editors for or
definitely. They go through everything and they really pick and choose. We try to stay out of their way because they're so good at it, especially as you can see with all the sound effects. They just make all these decisions that they really make the whole thing have momentum.
One of the things I want to say to you guys, and I was telling Carrie backstage a little bit, is you use your bodies in such great ways as actors, you know? I mean, these feel like really physical performances, and over the seasons, as you've gotten to know the characters more, just like, for example, seeing Spike and Iris, I mean, you know who they are physically now. Mm-hmm. And you must feel more comfortable now playing these people, don't you?
Definitely. I think, you know, this season we wanted to give the characters a lot of breathing room, and we wanted to focus on figuring out who they were and what other stories we could tell in their lives. And I think that allowed Fred and I as performers to really embody them, because we were telling more than just a small sliver from their life. And as I was telling you backstage in the finale this season, three different couples that Fred and I play get away. They get out of Portland, and it was in that moment where, you know, kind of going in and out of scenes as different characters, and I really felt like, okay, we got it finally. But it took a couple seasons where it wasn't just wigs or costumes as shorthand. Where it really, when that wig comes on as Nance, you know, I kind of like my bones melt and I just get really syrupy. And you know, and with Kath, you know, it's much more forward moving. And same with Iris. And I am more aware of it now when I watch it that. But it took us a while because we didn't used to give the characters a lot of room.
No, I just saw watching the way Spike is leaning in. So if I didn't have a car, mm-hmm. would you still love me? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's such a great piece of performance.
Well, thanks. It's just that, you know, that's his whole existence is having a bike. So in a way, he's kind of looking in the mirror, you know. But yeah, so that's pretty much what that is, that it's his identity.
I was so shocked in the first episode of the season. I just went, that can't be Jello Biafra. That's
that was Jello Biafra.
That's completely unreal seeing him, because it must be an impersonator, because he must be dead or he killed by the Sandinistas or something. It's insane.
When we were writing the sketch, I was going to do it. And I was like, I'm going to just do like a Jello Biafra guy. You know, he's like, yuppies. The sketch is he wakes up from a coma and everything he sees, it's like we've all kind of become yuppies, but the word doesn't exist anymore. Not that I need to explain the joke to you, but so then we just thought, like, why don't we just get Jello Biafra? And then we did. And
he took it more seriously than anyone on our show. You know, because when Tim Robbins or Kirsten Dunst comes in, they're not worried about their performance. They're like, yeah, we're going to nail this. This is pretty easy. It's Portlandia. But like, but when Jello Biafra came in, he flew in the night before. We were shooting out like 20 miles outside Portland. So he came directly from the airport out into the wilderness, into a campsite. And we wrapped at 11. And we spent about another half hour with him while he just went over, you know, what his motivation was. And
he wasn't like everyone we encouraged to improvise. He didn't want to. He was more like, what are the lines? Which is pretty much him just saying, what happened? it's crazy. I remember I used to, like, I paid to go see the Dead Kennedys.
I missed the Dead Kennedys, but I saw him do a lecture basically about oil and based on a 7-inch he had put out, and like 5 minutes in I realized, oh, I might not want to be here. But but I was very excited at the same time. Just for, I felt, you know when you go to something and you're just like, I can't wait to tell people that I went there even though you're not enjoying it?
This might be one of those nights. Yeah. That's okay. We're okay with that.
You silver tongue flatterer, you. One of the things I can't help but feel embarrassed by having dreadlocks whenever, because whenever I see the show, the people with dreadlocks don't really come off so well on the show.
That's just how you see it. We're portraying them with love.
Is that what it is? Okay, yeah. Because they don't seem to be very lovely people, all these dreadlock people.
I think we're equal. We dole out the haircuts, you know, the wigs. Who has the biggest dreads? It would be the gutter punks, right?
Yeah.
I would say. Carrie's got this big, huge,
yes.
Huge mm-hmm. thing. I lucked out, and I only have like one little stringy thing of hair out here.
I mean, for me, the wigs so often make the characters, and you guys have such great wig makers and such great costumes. I mean, each of the outfits we see them in, defines the characters. And you must feel that way, too, when you put these things on, and it really helps you play the people, doesn't it?
Well, we need that shorthand, because sometimes we're filming 3 or 4 sketches a day. So when you, you know, are focusing really intently for 3 or 4 hours on one thing, and then you really just have, you don't have any time to transition, not, you know, emotionally, or, you know, it really takes, like, the shorthand of putting on clothes and feeling a different fabric against your body, or having something be loose-fitting, or wearing open-toed shoes. And I will say that our costume designer has won 2 Emmys for our show, actually.
I mean, sometimes we don't know. We'll write a character, and we're like, I don't know if this is a sketch, really. I don't know how this is going to work. But then they'll show up with a costume. We're like, oh, this will be fine, you know.
What was the first time that happened for you when they showed up the costume and went, oh, I can play this? Do you remember which character that was?
Oh, wow. I would say, I feel like the feminist bookstore ladies, even though we had started having costumes for it, the way they kept changing it, it became more like, oh, this is a whole world that we can keep expanding. So, because originally I thought, no, it just needs one, it's a sketch show, we just need one, but they kept having these different wooden necklaces, which I hadn't seen before. So, that's one of them.
You don't have an aunt or anything that wears, I feel like everyone has an aunt that just has wooden jangly necklaces. Yeah. And you're always like, as a kid, you're like being smushed up against her bosom and her like jangly necklace. She's like,
yeah. I got a few of those scars around my eyes from that smush. But, I mean, I love that bookstore, too. I love that space where, I just thinking back to the sketch with Steve Buscemi, where it's misspelled on the door of the bathroom, so you don't know if you can go in or not.
Yeah.
I mean, just that space alone is just...
That's a real place in Portland. It's a place called In Other Words, and everything you see on screen, that's all them. That's a real store. They have this chalkboard behind them with a calendar, and all the events on there... Every time we shoot, I'm like, this isn't real, right? And they're like, yeah, that's the stuff that's up there. I'm not exaggerating.
You're not.
Yeah.
They had that thing last time that just said, clone a pussy. And it was just... and it was in a reference to a cat.
Okay.
No, it actually wasn't. It was pretty gross.
I do feel this show has become really more of a performance thing for you guys in the last couple of seasons. And if that was something you arrived at just by accident, just from feeling these characters out more, or if you had planned, if you got more and more seasons, to try to slow things down a little bit.
I think it was more about because we had to do more episodes, we wanted to just, we had to explore it more so that it didn't get dull. It's just as simple as that. But we just couldn't repeat ourselves, and it's more fun for us, too, if we could just take them a bit further.
I also think fans are just drawn to characters, you know? Like, when I think of my favorite shows, it has a lot to do with character more than concepts. So, you know, sometimes we'll come up with an idea, and then we just realize, well, there's no relationship between Fred and I or whatever characters we're playing in that story. And then it feels flimsy. So we started to focus more on character as a way of kind of deepening the story and the writing. And then we would sprinkle in concepts and satire, you know, within that world.
But it's fun too to see, just talking about Jello Biafra, when other guest stars show up, like, you know, the tax lawyer who wants to play bass, and suddenly, mm-hmm. you know, there's Doug McKagan and and Annie Clark. I mean, just seeing, you guys must like it too when you bring in other people, just because it changes the energy of the show a little bit.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's, it's just, it makes it a really good work day, makes it fun. It's also fun for them, like they're into it. They're, you know, Duff wasn't used to acting, so it's kind of, it's fun for everybody to make someone do something.
But he's really powerful. I mean, he doesn't say much, and he's like this, almost like Yoda in this game.
Yeah.
When Carrie called me, I came up right away, and he just had this gravitas. I mean Carrie in the sketch. I didn't call him, and he came up right away to be on the show. But that actually, you texted him, and he did come up right away. But he did have this gravitas. He's very, very intelligent, and it just, he had also this, you're just like, you were in Guns N' Roses, like you do know everything somehow. You know this, you know the secrets of the universe, and also secrets that we'll never know. So.
But he's so still and so powerful.
And he looks like rock and roll. We wanted that in that scene, that person needed to look like they were from the rock world. And he just, head to toe, it looks like that.
But it makes me wonder, though, in terms of the Fred and Carrie you guys play on the show, mm-hmm. who are almost like kind of these sort of weird symbiotic roommates / lovers. Are they? What do they do exactly? How do you guys suss out who they are?
We leave it blank, you know. We sometimes think like it could be anything. They could be related, they could be best friends, it could be whatever, but we just leave it up to the audience.
I kind of think of it like when the White Stripes came out and there was that mystery of like
that wasn't a mystery, that wasn't a mystery. So you're like the Whites, brother and sister. I got you. But it's almost like Pee Wee's Playhouse, and you guys are in the two twin beds in that weird room.
Ernie and Bert, you know.
Because what I think, and I want to ask you about this, Fred, what you must like about this, it gives you a chance to really sort of play out a character and play out the relationships of other characters instead of just having to deal with the audience. You must like that interplay.
Oh, it's great. It's good because you could be subtle. You know, the camera's up pretty close. We could do a few takes of something. And also we could be pretty weird with whatever character we're doing. So it's like an indulgence almost. Like that storyteller guy, you know, the guy who was like talking about wine and stuff. I was just obsessed with that kind of person. You know, in a party when there's always that guy, you're like, why are we all listening to this guy? And it's always a nature story, like about a river, and then they almost died. Listen, the next time you're at a party, they almost died. And I'm like, yeah, of course you almost died. You're on a, you know...
but that sort of thing, because I can sort of see your pleasure in getting a chance to sort of do these things and really use your voice, and just each of these characters sounds so different. Like you're playing Peter, it's almost like he can't breathe, he's so strangled by wanting to please.
Yeah,
I mean, and you must love getting the chance to just really use the voice in that way.
Yeah, he's the limpest guy ever. You know, it's just soft. He's soft inside and out, you know.
Yeah, but that staccato is just like this, it's like a yappy dog kind of. You know, when we were doing the driving thing, I got so mad at Fred. He gave me whiplash. And
there is a shot in there. I actually feel, we went through a couple of days where I felt terrible. Because, you know, for the shot, we don't have stunt people. And we have to really do things. And then I really did hit the brakes pretty hard. And they left it in, luckily. She does actually get really mad at how much I'm...
A lot of that, like, you're driving like an effing pussy was like... I mean, I was really pissed.
I'm sorry, but we had to...
And we actually had nowhere to go. We were filming a scene. Like, technically, you were doing everything you were supposed to do, but I was like, let's just go somewhere.
It circles. I'm frustrated now thinking about it. It is really... It's so stressful.
And I will say normally, and Fred will concur, anytime we're doing anything physical or driving, every other character, it's always me that's doing it. Because I insist. I'm like, no, please, let me drive, let me get in the river, let me hang from this thing, I'll fall off the couch.
Yeah, the ghost one. We did this one with Kirsten Dunst where we're ghosts.
Oh, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, and we're supposed to get a baseball bat and smash a lamp. And just in the script, you know, John was like, okay, well, Fred, you grab the baseball bat. And then we all knew in our hearts, we're like, that's Carrie. She's going to... She's going to make it look good. And she did. You nailed it.
Yeah, I'm like the designated hitter.
But I mean, that sketch just kind of really sort of hits for me. One of the things that's central to the show is that people get this piece of information, they kind of repeat constantly. And that's such a great sort of thing to do, because it shows how these people, you were talking about identity before with Spike, and their identity isn't these sort of, because nobody really does anything, so they talk about this one thing, and they just keep holding on to that information.
It's that thing about when you think it's supposed to be about like what your body's supposed to do, like cavemen used to, you know, sit a certain way. Why do we do that? We're not supposed to. It's that kind of argument that people have. Like, it's like that's what the cavemen did. It's the sort of thing that the human body is designed for. Am I crazy? Am I saying?
No, we all maybe we all agree with you, Fred. You're absolutely right. I'm your host here. One of the things I think is really brave about this show is the way you guys are constantly using kids. Mm-hmm. Like in the eco-terrorist sketch. That kid's kind of amazing.
Yeah, Matthew.
Yeah, he's a local Portland actor, and he's great. He improvises all that stuff.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, remember those twins?
Oh my God. Why were they even there?
Sorry, the twins.
We had these twins, right? Do you guys remember the one where like we got this kid we wanted to send to a school?
Grover. Yes.
That's twins.
We blocked him out.
And
they were wonderful. Grover was wonderful, but the only way that you could get either of these kids playing Grover to do anything was to do this really complicated high five with them. Yeah. So it was like they'd be really nervous, and their mom would be like, do the high five thing. We're like, okay. This is like 20 different moves with your hand.
Yeah.
And then they would relax for 1 second.
And
then you would
the
do
shot.
It again. Yeah. And you're like, it was very complicated. But their Grover comes back this year, played by another kid.
Yeah. No disrespect to that family. It's
no,
just,
they were you know. So nice.
Yeah,
and
they were nice to be there.
Yeah.
But still, that was a funny
dogs
day.
Dogs, too. I love dogs, but after we did Pet Haven, I was like, I hate dogs. They were very...
I love Marley so much. That dog was so great.
They were.
Yeah. Well, you know what happened is someone brought a ferret. And I was like, that's not a dog. Mm-hmm. And it smelled.
Yeah.
No, that's a good lesson to know. Ferrets are not dogs.
Yeah.
But I just thought the kid, Matthew, he was also in the sketch where you show up with the birthday gift 10 years after he's born.
Yes.
I mean, he has an enormous amount of confidence. He's just kind of reading the riot act. And
That really was him going off. We explained the sketch to him, and he just talks and talks. He makes up little stories. He's really incredible.
Yeah, he's a wonderful actor, and we give him a lot of leeway. We've had him. He was in the Rube Goldberg sketch last year, and we'll bring him back over and over.
No, it's like when just finding people like that. Like I go back to oh my God, the Ronald Moore.
Oh, we love yeah.
Yeah.
Chico, that's the and he showed up with his brother was auditioning. His brother's been on the show before, and his brother came in.
What did his brother play?
His brother was in the reggae band the first season. He is a musician and an actor, and so he came in. We wanted him to read for this part, and Henry or Chico, as he goes by, was just kind of hanging out. And John said, "Let's audition you," and he got the part.
He was perfect.
Yeah, it was perfect. And now he's on the show all the time.
Yeah, not an actor. He is not an actor.
No, you can kind of tell.
But we love that awkwardness sometimes, and the kind of realness that comes in those moments of just discomfort. You know, things just kind of hang there for a moment, and our editors love that. Sometimes Jonathan will talk about how he'll let a swallow happen. You know, like the camera stays on one of the actors too long, and you see the swallow. Jonathan loves stuff like that.
Because what I think is interesting about that too is the way that non-actors kind of hold the space because they don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. So it creates this thing that you're not, it's some sort of subconscious where you know you're not just watching a sketch. And again, that changes the performance for you guys too, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think also sometimes like greatness is overrated. You know what I mean? Like when someone's really, really good, it just sort of takes over and it just washes over you. It's good if they're a little, you know, stilted, a little stuttered, in my opinion.
Yeah. I also think it plays into the clumsiness that we're trying to encapsulate, you know, in terms of people's relationship to their environment. You know, they're in concert with it or they're in conflict with it. And if you have people that aren't trained actors, sometimes they can just bring that to a scene no matter what. And it really, we do a lot of cutaways to extras that don't talk.
Like, you ever see Josh? You know, the kid in the dumpster divers?
Yes.
And he's... No. he's just like, he's like a mannequin. Mm-hmm. Just, and he's really like that, even off camera. Mm-hmm.
I spend all my time with Josh trying to get him to talk to me, yeah, and he will not.
Is he that guy in real life?
He is that way.
Is he that guy in real life?
He doesn't talk. Yeah, he is. He's taciturn. He's very sweet. I thought he was like 16. He has a kid. When he said he had a kid, I was so shocked. And then I was like, oh, you're 30. But he looks 16 or 19. And I was like, oh, you've had relations with someone. You made a baby.
Yeah. And I always want him to have stories about how his life has changed after the show. I'm like, how's everything going? He's like, really good. And that's it.
But that's the thing that makes the show, that awkwardness you're talking about, it makes it so key, because so often sketch shows are kind of about a sort of fluidity, and there are lots of awkward silences in the show. Mm-hmm. And that sort of creates this tension that's part of comedy, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. And that, I have to credit the editors with that as well. Definitely. They definitely make, they go to extremes with that.
Well, I was thinking about the hide-and-seek team. Mm-hmm. Well, there's lots of weird signs. That woman finally goes, why don't you go get a job somewhere?
Yeah, yeah.
Was she a trained actress? Or?
She's a local actress named Ellen Bloodworth, but she, I think she did some work in Chicago.
Yeah, with Jerry Orbach and the whole, she was in a pretty established theater scene in Chicago and New York, and then ended up moving back to Portland because she was raising a family. And so she actually comes from a pretty, intense lineage. And she is ornery, though. Yeah, I mean, she's...
She's terrifying.
She rolls her eyes a lot.
She is judging nonstop.
Yeah. And she has an Academy Award tattooed on her.
That was real. Adult babysitter sketch, that was obviously, we did not script that. We did not know that she had that tattoo.
No, she did that.
And she said, look what I just got. And we're like, well, that's in the scene now.
Because that's like something of a Stephen King movie. What prison did you come from that they put an Academy Award on your arm?
It's
really weird. But that's, again, so much, and even when you did SNL, it's all about keeping a schedule. And, you got to move the sketch through because you got to get done so you can get the commercial breaks, so you can get the band on. Mm-hmm. You've got to love that sense of letting all these accidents happen here.
Yes, but also it's a pretty low-budget show, so we do have to keep moving throughout the day, changing characters and stuff. So we indulge it a little bit, but we do sometimes have to sort of cut it off and keep going.
Mm-hmm. I mean, often though, the first take, if we're not getting coverage, if we're just, doing the three camera, wide shots, can be 35 minute takes.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What's that like?
It's intense because you just think someone's going to call this.
Yeah.
Someone's going to end the scene.
In our head, we're going, John, are you going to say cut?
Yeah. And he lets it go. And sometimes, because often we're carving out the meat of the scene, and then when we go again, the next, take can be 2 minutes because he just wants this one part. Especially if we're, working with someone like Maya Rudolph, who appears later this season, or Steve Buscemi, he wants those to allow those people to really find that character. And it's really wondrous to watch, especially when you're working with, or like Jeff Goldblum. I mean, letting that guy find a tangent, and he'll find it fast, and he stays out there. But it's amazing to watch.
There's a sketch we did called The Pullout King.
Oh my God, yes.
Yeah. And so for his commercial, that's all him just making stuff up. Just like, it's so good. He's like, there's a sale.
Why did you hit Alex? Why did you hit him? What's that all about? Yeah. You can just see he's just completely, part of this, you guys are almost watching, what are you going to do next?
Totally. Yeah, he's amazing.
But just also seeing that kind of incredible, weird confidence that Kyle MacLachlan has, mm-hmm. That's kind of wonderful to watch too, because you want to believe somehow that's what the mayor of Portland must be like.
Yeah.
Yeah, just that much moxie and ignorance, and it somehow meshes together to be somewhat effective, or charming enough to seem effective.
I mean,
which is how most politicians are, I guess.
Yes, I'm not sure. Exactly, I'm not sure how effective this, but one of my favorite things, which is almost like Beckett, is that sketch you guys are waiting to get into the breakfast restaurant, and you're waiting for him to show up. You're not sure if he's ever going to show up. Then you go into the pharmacy, which probably isn't a restaurant, but I guess maybe it's a restaurant. Mm-hmm. Then he shows up at the end, and it turns out to be that restaurant. I mean, that, to me, is the thing I'm talking about, was all the awkwardness, but it takes its time. And did you know, I mean, because that's pretty late in the series by that point when you guys did that. It really felt like something that wouldn't have happened in the first season of the show. It's about having confidence in all the characters, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is.
Is that the end of the first season or the end of the second season? End of the second season. Yeah, I think, you know, that was one of my most cherished like shooting days when we did Brunch Village. And it was, you know, I think we had it scripted out, not dialogue wise, but we had the story scripted out. And I guess there was a certain confidence we had going into season two that I think has grown since then. But, you know,
that felt like when the show really hit its stride, because that feels almost like you're like doing a film version of SCTV. We get to see the entire Portland and so many of these characters running through it, but everybody gets an amount of time, but you're moving the thing forward. I mean, that felt kind of magical to me watching that piece.
Yeah, and our production design team, and you know, when it's Tim Robbins and Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols, and it's the Brunch Village, like the sort of, I don't know, the leader of Brunch Village. Our production design team had actually created a whole city block of these headquarters, and we only shot a fraction of it. But that dedication from our crew, and I think from everyone involved, that we imagine something so much larger than what ends up on screen. And I think that ends up coming across in just the joy of it and the intention of it. I mean, there's so much detail that you never see on screen.
Because, I mean, I wonder for both of you guys, I'll make this kind of a last question. SCTV feels like it's a really big influence on this.
Tremendous. For me personally, too. I mean, Rick Moranis, just all those guys, the way those sketches, they really were a huge influence on me. And I think on the show as well, I would say.
I agree. I wanted to also point out that two of our writers from this season are here tonight, Graham Wagner and Carrie Darnetto.
Are
you here? Did you guys show up? There they go. There they are, right there. It's these two.
And let's thank these guys for being here. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you. Elvis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Elvis Mitchell with the creators and stars of Portlandia, Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein. The Treatment is produced by me, Jenny Radelet, and mixed by Melissa Morton. If you like the show, leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks to Film Independent at LACMA for recording this interview. For more information and screenings, visit filmindependent.org/LACMA.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.